working environment of vineyards. And which is going to have all sorts of conversations for here at Columbus that I'm going to be talking about in a moment. And he said, you know, I see that you're an excellent gardener and what pains you take. And then there's sort of a test, right? Even now, you know, there's a test between to find out if his father really missed him, really loves him, if there's really the connection. Yeah. So he tells a lie to his father, basically. He makes up a who he is, and then one of his Cretan tales. But anyway, and then but then how does Odysseus convince his father that how does he convince his father that it's really him in the end?
He shows him the sky and talks to him about the conversation he had in the orchard.
About the gardens, right? And he says, furthermore, I will point out to you the trees in the vineyard which you gave me, and I asked you all about them as I followed you around the garden. We went over them all. You told me their names and what they all were. You gave me 13 pear trees, 10 apple trees, and 40 fig trees. You also said you gave me 50 rows of vines. There was wheat planted between each row, and they yield grapes of every kind when the season of fruit has been laid heavy upon them. And then Laertes' strength failed him when he heard the convincing signs, the same as us, which his son had given him. And so, I find it very interesting that we're in this imagery of the garden, that all the clues have to do with vineyards and trees and number of trees and all these things, and this word for a garden like this is actually a word we just saw, which I'm so glad that John brought it up. Olbia. Does anybody know what this word Olbia is? I mean, it's happy, but what else can it mean? Wealth, yes. Now that's what it means, especially for the uninitiated. It's just wealth. But there's something a lot more to it for that. And a garden that is really fruitful, that is really abundant, is olbia. And what else is olbia? Yes, fertility. And how can a community be fertile and prosperous?
We're trying to make sure it's blessed.
Blessed. Yes, blessed. And blessed has sort of a religious connotation to it, doesn't it? And that religious connotation is hero cult. Community that has good relations with its heroes, that, you know, has cards, that has exchange reciprocity with its heroes, that worship heroes is fertile and abundant and prosperous and old love. And a hero, someone who has hero cult, someone who is worshipped as a hero, is Olbia. So it has a lot more, it's kind of like the word blessed in English, how it has a lot more connotations than just happy. Although I think it might be losing the connotations in English. So this garden imagery is really important. And what about, do you have any ideas on why his father is the last person and not Penelope? Because so many of you are so interested in your papers in the ascending scale of affection, you might not have realized that this series of reconnections is in many ways like an ascending scale of affection for Odysseus. But here we find his father at the top. Anybody have any thoughts on that? It kind of goes back to a lot of what we were talking about last time. And what is the significance of fathers in this kind of tradition?
Wow. The opens with Telemachus going by his father, and it's only saying that Priamus goes to this is like Telemachus before the goes to his father.
And we see that, so we see this continuity of father-son relationship. And what does that mean for the culture that we've been studying, for the literature that we've been studying? I guess I'm thinking of things like Patroclus' name, or or what these, I think somebody brought up in their web discussion about living up to the glory of your ancestors, of your fathers in battle, but also it, you're inheriting the glory of your fathers, and you want to create glory for yourself to be passed down to your son.
I think it's a point that follows this too. I think fathers are very rarely, or sons are very rarely better than their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's true for fathers as well, but in this case, it's a better man than the stronger man.
Yeah.
It's a higher place, than the stronger man. I don't necessarily think that's true.
But the tradition, the living on of the tradition, is very much connected with one's ancestors and one's descendants.
Also, when Odysseus goes down to Hades, the most important thing Achilles asks him about is his father.
Oh, wow.
That is.
Yeah. And
Agamemnon
also asks
about
Orestes. Yes. Yeah, totally. So we've seen this sort of father-son connection on and on. And also, we need to think about the importance of fathers and ancestors and all this whole thing is, we talked about this before, about the connection between lament and song. Who is it that performs these laments?
Women.
Typically, okay. It's the family who mourns the hero, right? Who is the inception point for lament and for playoff, eventually.
Although, couldn't it be any of the hero?
Oh, sure. Yeah, any healer. But I think the most basic relationship that it comes down to also where else have we been? The end of the Iliad. We can't leave that out. Somebody tell me what happens in the end of the Iliad.
Priam spurred his son's body and finally receives it from Hector after talking to Achilles and reminding him of his own father. And, that.
And what did they do together? They cry, they lament together over the idea of fathers losing sons and sons losing fathers, and just they connect through the weeping for fathers. And Achilles is also weeping for himself because he's going to die soon, he's going to leave his father without a son, he knows his father's going to be lamenting him, and there's just all sorts of, we just touched on so many important father-son relationships, along the way, it seems to be. And this is something I'm reading this into it again, for the first time. I never saw anything about father-son relationships before, but it's just that I never realized how key it is to this story, I think.
I was just thinking that in for Meleager and for Achilles, it seems like, if you're talking about ascending scales of affection, for both of them, it doesn't really seem like the fathers have, like, they both sort of describe the place of their fathers, especially Meleager, who, won't enter battle with his father. But it's interesting, I think, that both of them, and I know I've said this before, but, the Patroclus and Cleopatra, they're both, neither of them are, in father-son relationship, but their names directly refer to the same sort of glory of the ancestors, glory of the father. And so despite the fact that the ascending scale of affection is very different, what's at the heart of it is this sort of going back to your roots, to your ancestors.
I have such a good point.
I was just saying, because you had also mentioned that, the sad thing with your dad about being a father, or about having children.
But that's, both of those are very good points. And he said that, before I even got to see my grown-up son, I never even got to see him grown up. I left him when he was a baby.
So our conclusion is that an ascending scale of affection still works, except there's a basic relationship between father and son. I don't understand what that.
Well, it's different for every hero, right? There's not one ascending scale of affection, but I think if you read Odysseus's root series of reconnections, which you don't have to, but I suggest that it may be one, that the series of reconnections is an ascending scale of affection, then Odysseus is at the top. And Odysseus's father is at the top of his. That's all I'm saying. But from Gretchen's point, what I think is interesting is that, yes, so in each story, Cleopatra was the, the top and then Patroclus. But at the heart of their names, what they sort of represent in many ways is Plato. So you could say Meleager went back to battle because of his wife. You could also say he went back to battle because of the glory of the ancestors. And so it's